pull back a little.
Good morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We will open the meeting by reading the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. ULT is one of many lodges situated in various parts of the world. All of these lodges are working together in a spirit of unity and harmony in an effort to form a nucleus of a universal brotherhood, first among ourselves, and then spread throughout this idea around the world, so that all mankind in the course of time will come to the realization that life is one. We carry out this program, this spiritual movement, we like to call it here in Philadelphia, by two weekly meetings. One meeting is held on Sunday morning at this hour from 11 to 12, and then the second meeting is held on Wednesday evenings from 7:45 to 9 o'clock. Now, on Sunday mornings throughout the month of February, there will be a theme upon which all presentations will be based. And that theme is Investigation of the Hidden Laws of Nature. And the talk for today is The Hidden Side of Nature. Next Sunday morning, there will be a panel presented entitled Mental Healing and Hypnosis. Following all of these Sunday morning meetings is always a time for questions and discussion. On Wednesday evenings throughout the year, we have been studying the ocean of theosophy, and now we have reached the chapter on reincarnation. And this coming Wednesday, reincarnation will be discussed from the standpoint of proving its authenticity. There is a reference library located here, and it is open each Wednesday from 5:30 until 7:30. It carries theosophical literature, books, pamphlets, and magazines, as well as other texts that might interest you. There is always a student available to lend assistance in answering questions and helping you to locate references. You may purchase literature either during the library hours or before or after each meeting. All activities of this lodge are free. The lodge continues to be sustained entirely by by voluntary contributions of time, service, and money, and all are most welcome to participate. The following is the reading in connection with the morning's talk. There is an occult side not only to our own nature, but to the nature of all beings, as should always have been apparent to us. If we had been observant, had we thought for ourselves, had we not taken for granted what others have handed down to us as religion or revelation. For there are stages in our very daily lives which are hidden from us. While we are awake, we operate through the body. Then we sleep. We do not operate through the body. And that side of our nature is hidden to most people. How could it be possible to describe the operations of the occult cosmos in terms of materialistic science and philosophy? That hidden cosmos is ideal in its fitness, in its fineness. But it is no more hidden than is the process by which the body builds itself up every day, nor than that by which a thought will affect the entire nervous system. A simple thought will bring a hot flush or a cold shiver. How? No one knows. Certainly, no scientific terms exist to describe the mode and means whereby the thought connects itself with the human physiological machine. Our search for knowledge is almost universally a looking for something outside. We are looking for information, for instruction, in the thoughts of other men, in the ideas of other peoples, which, in this school of occult knowledge, is not knowledge at all. The only knowledge we can have is that which we gain for ourselves and within ourselves as actual experience. External facts and information can never give us any understanding whatever of the higher, more divine parts of our nature. The title of the talk for this morning is The Hidden Side of Nature.
Most people, in approaching this subject, see it in a very limited fashion, if they are interested and see it at all. And that is, they consider such a title to be an expression of the astral or inner electrical life of the universe. And people who are interested in that are often interested in the phenomena that can be produced and in the capacities, the powers. People will talk glibly about astral projection and claim to do it, even write books about it. People will talk about or sell books on how to control another's will, how to produce magical things. But that is the use of a negative aspect of all of this wisdom. The hidden side of nature, theosophically, is twofold. There is that inner astral electrical world that this world is merely a phenomena of. In other words, the reality lies within. But there is also our own hidden inner world, the world of thought and feeling and imagination and will. So we want to look at both of them. In considering the first one, it is of utmost importance to keep in mind that theosophically, every human being is a spiritual being working through form to gain experience and knowledge, which leads to wisdom. The form side of life is astral. It is electrical. What we see as the material side, even science tells us, is really just rapidly moving molecules held together by some force. Well, that force is the astral. So our real form is astral. Well, why don't we know that? Well, in some ways, if we look at our own use of powers, we do sense it. How do you move your hand? How do you say a word? How do you remember something? What are all these things that go to make up you as an expressive being? Not one of them is physical. Moving your hand is physical, but how did you do it? You thought it, and the thought turned into an electrical will impulse. What could be more hidden from us than the results of our own thinking and feeling and imagination? But back to the astral. If everything we do as physical beings begins in the astral, then obviously we are using it all the time. What people want is to be able to use it separately as itself, to move and function in the astral body, even though that is what they're doing right now through the physical. Well, why, if we already can do it, why not have that capacity? In a way, that's like saying, would you go just anywhere without the knowledge and wisdom of where you were going, what it was like when you would get there, what you required to bring with you? The astral light, the astral plane, is full of the same sorts of deceptions and disagreeable things that we have here on this plane. You wouldn't go just anywhere here. You wouldn't go in swamps without particular knowledge, and you wouldn't go in sewers without particular protection. But the astral that is closest to us is equivalent to a swamp or a sewer. It is a photographic collection of all of the thinking and feeling of humanity. If you want wisdom, you have to go much higher than that, and you have to qualify to go higher than that by the way you think and act, by the way you use the substance in your charge, your physical body, brain. So motive is key. There's something that most people don't think about. If you could, at this moment, astral project, let's just say you could, what would you do with it? People think of gaining the power. They don't think of what its use would be. We suppose any one of us would be giddy enough to just sort of, I don't know, travel all over the earth and see everything we could see. But then what? Of what use would it be to you if you didn't know yourself and you didn't know what was required of you as a spiritual being? If you then move it down to the immediate, all right, the astral can wait until I have progressed in mental capacity, in moral capability. I can earn the right naturally as a spiritual being. But what about the hidden side of my nature right now? And that is where we could easily begin as a scientist, literally being the observer of ourselves. What do I know about my thoughts? Are they my thoughts? Or did I adopt them from something I read, something I heard, something I was told? How much of my thinking is original, is my thinking? Probably very, very little. so I can begin to observe and watch my thoughts. What happens when I think along a certain way? Not trying to change it, but trying to understand the connection between thought and action. What happens if I use my imagination negatively? If I suspect that this person is thinking poorly of me, or I suspect that this might happen in my job or in the world, what happens within me based on the way I imagine? And what about feeling? We all know we are colored and controlled by feelings. And we all know that we're often in a situation where we said, I am not going to say that, I am not going to do that. And then our feelings overwhelmed us. So if we start there, in that hidden side of our nature, beginning to observe what goes on and contrasting it with what we are learning about life and its unity, about our responsibility in it, about karma, the law of life. For every action, there is an equal reaction. We will always get exactly what we have earned, no more, no less. That's the promise of karma. In other words, the difficulties we have right now had their source within our thinking, feeling, willing, and imagination. But of course, equally the good that we have. And we all have much uncredited good. And not, we don't mean waiting for others to credit us, but we take our skills, our talents, our abilities for granted. We've known them all our lives, and we don't think anything of them. But if you were to ask others, they would tell you some of the things you have are probably wonderful, and others wish they had them, just as you may look at someone else. But how do you get something, a skill, a talent, an ability? By application. And again, it is hidden. No one sees, even yourself, the struggles that you go through to learn something, to apply yourself to something. It is on the inner side of your nature, and you don't see it as a result until you have accomplished something. So it's already our own life experience. We know what we have to work with. We may, however, be, for one reason or another, deluding ourselves, thinking because we know something. We can maybe quote Theosophical Ideas. We know something. Well, that doesn't mean we can use it. It doesn't mean we can do it. It doesn't mean we have accomplished it. So we have to take a real survey of our capacities and our actual use of our skills. And why? Because we are told that the real growth comes from the life we manage to live. We can make our own physical brain porous to the higher wisdom that we all possess because we are spiritual beings. It isn't that we need to read a book or hear someone speak or be given some magic power. What we need is to take control of what is ours, our personal nature, and in controlling it, open ourselves up to what is already there within us. I want to read from Robert Browning's Paracelsus. For some people, abstruse intellectual material will send them into a kind of ecstasy that makes them ripe and ready for spiritual wisdom. For others, it's beautiful music. For another, it's a sunset and the stars. And for some, it's poetry. Wherever you find anything that uplifts you, return to it. Anyway, this is from Robert Browning's Paracelsus, and you should read the entire poem. There is an inmost center in us all, where truth abides in fullness, and around, wall upon wall, the gross flesh hems it in, this perfect, clear conception, which is truth. A baffling and perverting carnal mesh binds it and makes all error. And to know rather consists in opening out a way whence the imprisoned splendor may escape than in effecting entry for a light supposed to be without. And that, friends, is our biggest problem. We are looking for something without us to be given to us so that we can then be wise. But we are the us we're looking for. We have to turn within to that hidden side of our nature, of all nature, and realize that in reality, we and all of life are spiritual. And we have nothing to fear but our own ignorance. And guess what? Who can fix our ignorance but us? By relearning, by watching what we're doing, by caring that we learn all of this in order to share it in its fullness. Your questions are invited. Yes?
We heard the term spiritual being used quite frequently. What is the term mean?
We heard the term spiritual meaning. Is that
spiritual?
Spiritual. What does it mean?
Yes.
Ah, that's a good question.
Spiritual being. What is spiritual
being? Is that what you said? Spiritual being? If you were to sit down and write everything that you could possibly mean by spiritual, you would go into infinity. But taking it as the very basis of ourselves and of life, we are taught that the universe is merely a manifestation of an absolute infinite principle that comes forth and there is experience and then it's withdrawn. That is spiritual. But any individual anything within that is also spiritual. So the atom is as spiritual as we are. The difference is man, humanity, the thinker, is self-conscious and can weigh and choose and has therefore the freedom of the gods. If you imagine to yourself a god, what are the powers that they have? Thought, will, choice, memory, feeling, imagination. Those are the powers that we have. We are as gods within this universe of ours. And that is spiritual. There isn't anything that isn't spiritual, since it all comes from one essence and withdraws into one essence at the end of its activity, just as we have activity and rest, so universes and solar systems do. And for what purpose? For the purpose of growth and learning. There is learning taking place in any kingdom that we can think of. There's growth by natural impulse, by instinct. It is only the human that makes the choice of what they will learn, how they will learn. Yes. Wait. One second. Yes.
I wanted to take an opportunity. I have to leave for an airplane very soon. So I apologize.
Direct your remarks to the chair. Okay.
To you. Okay. I wanted to share with you my experience last week when I came in here. I was a guest last week, and I've been in town. Directing a television series.
An excellent television series.
I thank you for that. But last week, over the weekend with the weather and all, I was facing an enormous logistical
pressure,
personal challenge.
Yes.
To figure out how I was going to take 150 people out in the frigid cold and shoot the material that I had to shoot. The TV series is named Do No Harm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about a surgeon and his dark side. And
Jekyll and Hyde.
Better
yes.
intention. It's
yes.
Jekyll and Hyde. But as I sat in this chair, or that one, last week, listening to the conversation between you and this gentleman, and walking into the door and seeing Kush sitting there, who remarkably looks identical to a very dear friend of mine who passed last June, I was sitting here trying to figure out how do I do this, and I kept negotiating with the producer, saying I kept saying we can't do it. It's too much. It's too cold. The lead actor already said I'm not going to go out there and do what I have to do. Which, ironically, in terms of the scenes that we were doing, was enormously complicated special effects, where he literally, physically fights with himself. He brutally beats one of the characters.
Well, get back to what your experience
is. But this is relevant to what I'm saying. So while I was sitting here, I think it was you who was sitting in the back of the row, and you said, through the course of the conversation, so as best we can, our purpose is to do no harm. I think someone, I think she literally said those words, and there was a flow of conversation about doing no
that
harm.
We should mean to do no
that
harm.
That we should mean to
yes.
do no harm. Exactly. That was
yes.
what you mean. And then the gentleman over there began to discuss a surgeon, and if he, again, if he intends to do no harm. And all of a sudden I realized, through this communication that I was being offered to go, to just quit struggling and basically be receptive to this information and to what I felt was a remarkable convergence for me personally.
The interesting thing about convergences like that,
yeah.
One of the things we learn in the philosophy, it's very, very personal in this sense,
yeah.
You only receive what you left behind for yourself.
Yeah.
So in some instance, in some life, you dropped an answer for somebody, and therefore you picked it up again. So
the other component of this little story, I didn't know if we all finished.
No, then you'll be on an airplane.
Well, that's true. On to my next dropping of a But I have a very dear friend in Colorado who was my other close friend to my friend Charles, who Kush reminds me so much of. Her name is Bibi, and Bibi has been the most vigilant spiritual pilgrim her whole life. She's now in her early 50s and has traveled the world and struggled and through just the most massive personal commitment to spiritual growth, something that I've always admired about it. And she and I have shared an enormous amount of this. But I called Bibi and I told her about what I felt at the time was more than a coincidence,
mm-hmm.
that I just happened to wander in here and that you happened to talk about this and that I was here to receive it. And Bibi said, you know, theosophy founded by Madame Blavatsky. And she said to me, I've always felt that I was reincarnated Madame Blavatsky. That my continual religious, spiritual, passionate hunger came from somewhere, and that was my, she told me that. Just
right. Well, one would have to consider perhaps she was a student of, because we don't think Madame Blavatsky's hunger was for wisdom and further experience, but rather opportunity to serve. This is a personal opinion. We've always thought if you wanted to send someone to do the most public expression of these teachings, consider that in ages past, we had to literally be a neophyte to even get close to these teachings. We had to dedicate our lives and souls and great sacrifice. Now we can buy a book and take it home, and we own the teachings. We don't possess them, but we own them physically. So if you wanted to do that most public expression, would you send out the least or the best? And we think you would send out the highest, perhaps masquerading as just a woman. But even then, in her day, people respected and admired her and what she knew. But the fact is, there really is no coincidence for any of us. And when we have to really remember that is when the bus in pulling past us splashes us, or the neighbor never returns something that's very precious to us. That's when we have to remember there is no coincidence. This is mine, and that's why I have it. Good luck on your plane trip.
Thank you.
And we hope you will come back. Yes.
In tying together the previous question and the comment here, regarding our inner struggle and conflict, Mr. Judge wrote in a letter that we will know that we're touching the spiritual plane, our being, when the struggle drops away and we know we are already more than that, perfect.
Right.
When time ceases to exist, worrying about the past and present, and we no longer feel ourselves separate. We are eternal, and nothing mm-hmm. can affect us. We're one with spirit. So the more we come in contact with that, whether it's these
experiences,
the more we know we're on the right track.
And what's wonderful about those epiphanies, I mean, they don't last. If they lasted, we would be one with wisdom. We have that glimpse. We taste it. We realize it in its enormity, and then we're back to our ordinary day. But we never forget it. If you taste that once, then you know, nothing's going to stop me. Nothing. And that is our task, to keep going, to keep moving forward. Yes?
You mentioned that we should seek not from without, but seek from within. Aside from reading literature and books, etc., how would you recommend doing that?
All right. How would we recommend seeing within? Doesn't it begin with the questions that we ask and the demand of ourselves to get answers? And where does it go from there? Well, there are devotional books. One might appeal to an individual more than another. There's The Voice of the Silence, which is a book written for disciples of these great teachings. There's Light on the Path. There's the Bhagavad Gita, which is enough food for a century. There's things that you can do with that. You can memorize phrases. You can research a little help book for yourself. Which words, like Mr. Judge's letters, which words would help me live with this problem right now. Moving from that, there is meditation, a practice of turning inward towards the divine, not to gain anything for yourself, but to put yourself in harmony with your real nature. And that is why there is no group meditation here, because it is an individual practice. And then there is service. You seek to serve in any way you can, at work, at home, here, wherever. You seek to give the best of yourself to the world around you. And then you are on a journey. And life will bring you coincidences. Maybe someone will give you a book. And yes?
In the poem you read,
Browning's Paracelsus. Yes.
Yeah. Browning expressed. It got me thinking about this sort of what I interpret as a stark duality between of physical body and inner life. Mm. And just based on his language, because he referred to the physical body and almost pejorative terms.
Yes.
You know, like,
in comparison, though.
Carnality. Exactly. And perhaps it's more powerful because of that language. But but it got me thinking, I mean, must we see that duality as being so stark?
Good point.
Or, you know, is it more...
We think we have to see it as so stark right now because all of our adoration is on it. It's everything. It's wonderful. It's all we want. We're facade adorers. And as long as we do that, we will never pay attention to what is real and true. And we'll go on life after life satisfying the same stupid desires. You know, Theosophy says, as a humanity, we have been incarnating for 18 million years. Not all of those years, certainly. But even if we say, you know, I come back every 5,000, that's still a lot of incarnations. What have we learned? We have learned how to be very clever physically. We do amazing things. And if you read back in the history of what wise, developed souls that we would call sages or seers or masters or saviors, what they did spiritually and astrally, we now do physically. We can do everything that is listed as their powers and capacities. I can pick up a little piece of machinery and bing, I can call India. Or I can send a message to an individual in India. These are physical representations of what have been known for thousands of years without the physical means. So the reason it's put in such stark terms, it's like a slap in the face. It's like, go clean your room. Wake up. It isn't, though, the abomination of the universe. The human body is the most magnificent, incredible structure. If any of you are interested at all in engineering or in clever construction, just read about the foot. When you think what your foot has to put up with from you, I mean, it's amazing. You can keep gaining weight, too. And your foot, that bridge, will keep allowing you to do so. That isn't where you'll break down. The fact is that it is a wonderful, precious thing. And the soul is always eager to come back and learn more through that experience. So we agree, it is stark, but it does not have to be. We should be reverential to our own body and the bodies of others. Wasn't it Carlyle who said, don't you know you're in the temple of the living God? You are that living God. Treat this like a sacred place. Respect it and cherish it. Yes?
To return to that comment about humanity, what have we learned? Is it possible to also think of it as humanity in the past, just as we as individuals, may have done things in much higher ways, maybe more things or acquired spiritual knowledge or astral knowledge, perhaps misused it. But in order for evolution to proceed, this is where we have to be now to work and then to move forward. So it's not necessarily a bad thing that we are in this condition. It could be a necessary
thing. A very necessary thing. Actually, it is called a pilgrimage. The soul is on a pilgrimage that is dual. We're not here just to learn for ourselves or to share with each other. We're here because the whole of nature is waiting to be uplifted, and it can only be uplifted through our use of it. If you think about it, all of Earth passes through you. It's a constant coming and going through our breath, through the food we eat, through everything about us, astrally and physically. There is this exchange with the entire planet, with everything on it. So we color and affect all of the life that passes through us. maybe a simple example, because we've probably all experienced it, is you're eating and something happens and you get angry. You feel it immediately in your own gut. You feel this is not pleasant at all. But there's more than that. It is what you are then throwing out into the lower kingdoms with your feeling. There has to be a safety valve for it. And the philosophy says that nature uses the lower kingdoms as a safety valve. So enough of us have negative, nasty, awful thoughts, and we have a tornado or an earthquake, because nature has to have a way to vent our negativity. So it is necessary, but it's necessary in the way it is because of the choices we have made individually and collectively. And perhaps the best thing that any one of us can have besides these teachings is to be around someone who is calm and centered, because they bring that out in us, because it makes us want to have the same qualities. And what we want to have, we will have. Yes?
Can we say the opposite, though?
Almost always, yes.
When it was just mentioned about how our thoughts, you know, there needs to be a release if there's so much negativity. But can't we also say the opposite, though?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because there is a lot of wonderful people out there doing incredible things. So we're hoping then that all these wonderful things are populating.
Well, of course they are.
To balance.
Well, as long as we have advertising and music and attitudes and opinions that degrade anyone, as long as we have that, it doesn't matter how much good is done. If you have the baseline as negative, then the good is like a beautiful sky, but you're still dealing with a slum beneath it. The important thing is if we support what is healthy and good and kind and make that a promise to ourselves. Not to denigrate anyone else who doesn't, but to realize, oh, that's where I was. How many years ago? That's the way I thought and behaved. They too will come around when they get the chance if we keep the attitude in front of them. As souls, all of us want beauty and love and truth. And what we do is get twisted because we think it's been taken away from us or it's been prevented. So it's love turned on itself. That's all it is. Yes?
You mentioned nature has a natural venting mechanism when injustice or evil or impropriety is done.
Well, no, when it builds up.
So my question is, the ancient advanced civilizations that were vented off, how is it possible that they knew what we haven't even began learning yet or attempting to learn?
When you say they, though, do you realize you're talking about us? We may have been the young ones then, the young innocent ones. And what happens to youth? It tries to imitate sometimes without understanding how to do something or what is the right reason for doing something. So perhaps back in Atlantis, we as individuals had the opportunity to see and witness great learning and great beings. But we ourselves, instead of studying, learning, imitated. How many of us ever went for a grade rather than the knowledge? Yeah. Yeah. You know, you just cram the night before and get the good grade. Of course, you then don't remember one word of it a year later. But That's again that outward looking. We are looking for the grade or other people's opinion of us instead of the quality, the true quality that then resides within us. So those who make that grade, who achieve that level, and we all know this, did the work. And then they continue to do the work. We are still hiding behind pretended things. Yes?
As was stated earlier this morning, you said the hidden side of nature. Well, we look around and we see in this room that we don't look alike. There are lots of differences. Yet we understand each other. We understand the language, we do this together. It can't be because of what we see, which is understood as each one's nature and so forth. So the hidden side of nature then infers a unity hidden that makes it possible for all these different personalities to function together and at least understand the words, but they cannot, it seems that we cannot get it from looking around this room. We have to go somewhere else. Is that the commonality that you were referring to? Because we can't see.
You know, in the daily routine of every one of us, there is something hidden that is so magical and powerful that if we could, and theosophy says we can, but you have to cultivate it, that if we could remember what we go through in the deep sleep state, we would realize these masks we're wearing are really just experiences. The way we have used substance in the past, the way we're thinking and feeling now, create those conditions. Don't they say the face you have after 50 is the face you earned, something like that? Well, the face you have your whole life is what you earned in past lives. But if we could touch the memory of that deep sleep state, we would realize our unity. We would also realize that we not only communicate with each other, but we communicate with higher beings. Why? Because there are elder brothers. They want us to come to their status, to their station in life. Look within, thou art Buddha. If you realize that, if you really realize that, what would stop you between now, in the condition you're in, and Buddhahood? Nothing. And that's what we have to do. Theosophy serves to explain the hidden side, the real and inner meaning of all things, for it is a friend to understanding, an aid to knowledge. By it, a man may come to know himself through and through. We are not working because of our self-interest in the results, but for masters and for humanity. So we will take cheerfully whatever comes, enjoy or suffer, whatever the higher self may have in store for us by way of experience or discipline. It is for us to go on without doubt or anxiety. Both are hindrances which spring from the lower nature, not the higher. We suffer and must continue to suffer from the bodily and mental weaknesses of the human race. We can cheerfully endure all this when we are working for a better time, better minds and bodies, better understanding for the whole of humanity. So the fact that the world may not be paying attention to any of this has nothing to do with us. Our task is in front of us. Our capacities are what they are. If we want more, work harder. Give more to get more. Yes.
on the outer side of nature, our communication and influence of another seems to be limited by space, by time, by matter. But as mentioned before, when we are aware of the inner unity and are focused there, sometimes we notice that we're thinking of something in the room and somebody else
says it. Right.
Or we're all, many of us are thinking of the same idea and somebody else did. So it makes us wonder that part of this inner reality is the ability to affect others, not just other human beings, but all of life, that our thinking and feeling is not limited in that hidden side.
I think Mr. Judge puts it that if you go around thinking, oh, woe is me, life is awful, conditions are terrible, you're sending that out as this cloud that will color and affect anyone who is receptive to it. If, however, you were to think, there is hope, there is possibility, there is truth, and you can find it. If you send that out, that colors and affects soul and life differently. We're always in charge of one thing only: our own thinking, acting, feeling, our own imagination. It's a serious responsibility. If you want to have a good time thinking about that, read the discourses of Epictetus. He slaps you in the face every few pages. We think one of the best ones was a student of his who said, someone stole my statue. And he said, yes, because you had it. If you tell Epictetus somebody said something terrible about you, he would say, well, obviously he didn't know enough to say more. He understood where you stood was all you owned. You have the right to accept. You have the right to reject. That's all you have. Be careful what you accept. He says, if someone brings you a criticism, listen to it. And if it makes you want to laugh, it isn't yours. If it makes you want to fight back, smile at the person and say thank you, because they've given you gold. Here is a fault, a flaw you didn't know you had. And now you see you want to rip the other person apart for recognizing it. Instead, take it as a gift, keep it, try if you can to make the changes. But if you can't, at least never forget, I have this to fix. Someday I hope I'm able to. So read Epictetus if you want a new and refreshing look at yourself as a chooser. Yes?
We also have to be aware that and this came from the reading, resist not evil. Sufficient to the day is the evil thereof.
Mm-hmm.
That introduces us to a very important aspect of the learning experience. We don't like it, and problems persist. How does one accept what's happening if it is, to them, painful?
Well, everything we don't want is painful, isn't it? But why resist not evil? We like to read a lot, and a wonderful series of books that teaches you a great deal about that through science fiction is called Thomas Covenant, The Unbeliever, in which he tries to fight evil, and it takes him many, many books to realize the more you resist something, the more power you give it, and the more it can hit you back. And we think a great example is a swinging door. If you push a swinging door, when it comes back very gently. If you shove it, it shoves back at you. Resist not evil. Don't fight it. Understand it. work through it, work around it, but don't try to destroy it. Yes.
Yes. Wasn't that the principle that Mahatma Gandhi applied practically?
Mm-hmm.
Passive resistance, not to resist physically.
And Martin Luther King
adopted the same one.
And his thing was, it isn't enough that you're saying, I won't fight the man. You have to not hate him as well. Yeah. Mr. Judge gives a great example of that. If you came upon a man beating a horse, you immediately, of course, want to stop him from doing that to this helpless animal. But then you usually want to beat him and to hate him, when you should stop and say, here is my brother who is in trouble. I cannot leave him in trouble. I want to not judge him. I want to see if I can help him. And if not, if he can get help some other way. He is my brother. He is in trouble. Oh, the things we have to learn. And we're so stubborn. We don't want to learn them. We don't want to resist evil. We want to grab goodness just for ourselves and run away with it. And if we get enough of it, maybe we'll share it. We're amazing, but we're also brilliant and beautiful, and could, if we just stop to look within, to take a few moments to realize our real nature and our real unity with all of life. It is a privilege to be in human incarnation. We shouldn't waste it. Yes.
From many of the things read,
I'm sorry.
From many of the things read and quoted from classical sources, contemporary ones, it seems as though that the hidden side of nature is where the causes of our problems lie, not in the
it's causes of our solutions too.
Yes, we're always trying to fix up.
Oh, yes.
The world,
yes.
Rather than understand the real causes are hidden from our outer.
Right. That's like that. That strange little joke, the person seeing the doctor, and the doctor points to the x-ray and says, here's the problem. You have this, and the person says, well, fix that. So they change the x-ray. That's kind of what we're like. We don't want to fix the problem. We want the solution to be painless and quick. You know, It's as though, you know, Shakespeare was looking into all of us. We lay waste our powers. The powers that we're using are godlike powers, and we use them in pathetic little ways. We're really comical. We would think somebody would write a great farce and make us all really look. We need a Mark Twain. That's what we need right now. And make us look at ourselves for the silly creatures that we are. We don't remember who said it, and we're going to mess up the quote, but it was along the line of, a human is the only creature in the world that denies itself, that acts as though it isn't what it is, which is powerful and wise and capable. And we act like weaklings. Well, our subject for February, the hidden side of nature, will go on for the next few Sundays, and we hope you will join us. Meeting is adjourned.